Welcome to Just Verdicts with your host, Brendan Lupitin, a podcast dedicated to the pursuit of just verdicts for just cases. Join us for in-depth interviews and discussions of cutting-edge trial strategies that will give you the keys to conquering the courtroom. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Greetings, fellow legal minds. You may have noticed a change. We are now Just Verdicts. Formerly Trial and Medical Error, our podcast is undergoing a transformation. We're zeroing in on what truly matters, the strategies, stories, and mindset behind remarkable jury verdicts. Please join me as we dissect the anatomy of legal triumphs, spotlighting the lawyers, jurors, and narratives that shape courtroom outcomes. From pivotal cases to insider insights, we're here to fuel your passion for the law. So, to all trial lawyers seeking inspiration and knowledge, welcome to Just Verdicts, where every verdict holds the keys to success.
On today's episode, I talk with attorney Mark Schultz. Mark is a longtime trial attorney, has had some spectacular results over the course of his career, but more recently, over the past 10 years or so, has transitioned into trial consulting, specifically performing focus groups for attorneys first in Pennsylvania, now all across the country. Mark talks about his influences, what got him into focus groups, what opened his eyes to the power of focus groups, one of which led to him getting a verdict of around $30 million. And that was several years ago when $30 million was probably worth like $300 million. And Mark talks about the best ways to format your focus groups, pitfalls he sees attorneys make, and the best ways to issue spot and do concept focus groups that are going to improve your chances, separate and apart from hiring somebody like Mark to do your focus groups for you. So I think you're going to enjoy this. You'll learn a lot about focus groups. So here's me and Mark Schultz talking focus groups. Mark, I'm so glad you're here today and that you hung in there with me with all of our tech setup initially to get you on here, but it's totally worth it because I'm super psyched to talk to you about focus groups and everything today. But I was thinking back yesterday when we talked about how you and I first connected, and I think it was through the original reptile listservs. And I think we were both on that and we talked about focus groups. And then you were kind enough to bring me into that crazy trucking case we had many years ago, on George's case.
Yeah.
And then you've done some focus groups for me over the years, and just a few different things about your background, and then maybe you can elaborate that I just think are fascinating. So number one, now is it true that most of your time is spent running and performing focus groups and trial preparation for other lawyers?
Yes. I have two cases that have a lot of gray whiskers on them in state court that I'm waiting to resolve, but I haven't taken any new cases, and I'm spending 98% of my time on other lawyers' cases, with a proviso that sometimes the lawyers choose to bring me into the case after I've done a couple of focus groups.
And what I'm interested in is how you transitioned out, because two things. Number one, in your heyday of trial work, you're a hell of a trial lawyer. I mean, didn't you get like some crazy $20 million verdict in a garage door case or something like that?
Yeah, it was in Indiana, in Indianapolis. It was $30 million. And although they allocated 15% negligence to the plaintiff, and that was kind of the case that kind of showed me the possibility of transitioning. I mean, I know a lot of lawyers, when they get into their late 60s and 70s, they want to become mediators or they retire. And I was in my mid-60s, and on that case, we did 15 focus groups. We hired a very prominent trial consultant in Indiana, and she ran the focus groups that we did. We would always do them on Saturdays on the theory that's when people aren't working and you get a broader variety of occupations in there. And I watched her and I said, this is a much better idea than being a mediator. I really had done some mediations and didn't like it. I'm just running numbers back and forth from the plaintiff to the defendant. And I thought, I can do this. This is not all that far from what I'm doing. And there are a lot of lawyers want a trial consultant who has a psychology background, and I get that. I understand it. But I found that a lot of lawyers, especially younger lawyers, appreciate the fact that I tried 60 or 70 cases to verdict, and they would sooner have me involved than a psychologist. I think there's a lot a psychologist has to offer. Certainly, it's a different orientation, but you know, it being an experienced trial lawyer, I have found a lot of lawyers would prefer to have me do the focus groups. And then some of them have actually, like I said, brought me into the case and I've entered my appearance. It's a great career second phase.
Mark, when you were exposed to all of those focus groups in that garage door case that led to that terrific verdict, was that your first real exposure to focus groups, or had you dabbled in them or had experience with them even before that?
I would say 1993, 94, I started organizing informal focus groups. In my office building, there was a real estate management company next door, and I would bring their employees into our conference room. And they were very conservative. And there's a company called ADR Options, which is fundamentally a mediation and arbitration company in Philadelphia, but they started getting into focus groups. And I had them do a couple for me. And it was kind of the light bulb went on when I started watching the jurors deliberate in those cases. And the focus group, the term focus group covers a lot of ground. All they did basically was they turned on the video camera. I had someone play the defense lawyer and we gave opening statements and had a phony witness pretend to be the defendant and then turned on the cameras while two different panels of jurors deliberated. And it was an amazing moment of recognition that I'm in the jury room and I'm listening. And this is what people are saying. And I said, this is great. This is amazing. And then I did another series of them for a case that I tried in 2007 in federal court in Philadelphia and leaned on it very heavily on the results. Listened to the deliberation video multiple times for clues and for ideas and ended up getting a really good verdict. And they had given me ideas and little sound bites that I was able to use. And at that point, I was hooked and started offering to do them for friends.
So tell me how you evolved. Light bulb goes off. You're personally able to use information from focus groups on your cases to get some terrific results. You've kind of got the focus group bug. Can you walk me through how you've gotten to now having your own focus group trial consulting company and how your approach to running focus groups has evolved?
Yeah, I did four or five of them for friends of mine. And I really enjoyed it. It went well. And I decided I needed a name. And I figured since I wanted to focus on Pennsylvania, I'll get into it later. This is obviously long before the pandemic. And I didn't want to drive long distances. I wanted to do focus groups locally. So I used the name Keystone to signal that it was Pennsylvania. And I started getting a lot of calls and I started doing a little bit of advertising, just mass emailing for the most part. And I got a website going. And this is while I was still practicing pretty much full time. And the majority of people, some of whom were really good lawyers, had never done a focus group. These are people who I know have tried lots of cases. I respect their ability, had never done one. And pretty much it was, I think I'd like to try this.
How did you, I mean, when you first started running focus groups for your friends, okay, so people reach out to you, they know you've got experience, you're interested in helping. What was the typical format that you would do then? And has it changed over time? And do you run different formats of focus groups now?
Yeah, I run several different formats. I try and kind of look at what the lawyer wants to accomplish and give some of my own input and organize the format of the focus group around that.
Walk me through that. I mean, so give me an example. Like what's something common and helpful that people want to accomplish?
Well, I did one on a drug case. And
what's a drug case? Is it a civil case or is it a
drug case? That's
a
good point.
Okay.
Yeah, civil case. Yeah, this is a case where a drug manufacturer is being sued for failing to warn about detrimental effects of their drug.
Yeah.
They're pretty common. And they're usually in the mass tort format. There's multiple lawyers involved, hundreds or thousands of plaintiffs. And in this particular case, and there's a lot of these cases, it focused on, did the drug company know about these detrimental effects, or should they have known? It really boils down a very simple premise on that. There's other issues, there's damages, but they have no duty to warn at all unless they either knew or should have known of the detrimental effects of the drug.
So how did you approach that focus group?
Yeah, I did it for kind of a well-known firm in this area. And what I did was, there's a lot of terms that fly around. One is called a concept focus group. And they came to me and said, we want a concept focus group and to focus on this issue. And what I did was, we did 4 hours, but we did two separate groups. We marched 10 people in at 10 o'clock and ran for 2 hours with them. And then we marched another group of 10 in at 1 o'clock and went till 3 o'clock with them. And basically the format we used is, look, the first thing we're going to tell you is there's this drug and it does potentially cause some detrimental side effects. And the whole issue, when I put the first thing I put up on the screen was the jury charge. I said, if you were a real jury, this is what you'd see. Basically, what did the drug company know and when did they know it? Kind of a Watergate thing. And this is, I want you to look at all the things you're going to hear. I want you to look through that lens.
Of the jury instructions.
Yeah.
And is that an approach you take in a lot of your projects? You use the jury instructions?
No. I mean, I think what happened was, and these were really experienced, smart lawyers who really wanted to focus on this issue. And in these cases, they're not concerned about things like what kind of impression does the plaintiff make? What kind of impression does our expert make? The kind of persuasion issues that you see in most cases. We showed charts with evidence of how often these side effects were appearing, when they were appearing. And we were bringing in 20 people. We got it wasn't like statistically significant sample, but it was enough that it gave them ideas. And there were like 8 lawyers in the side room. We did it in person, watching this go on. And on every break, they had a million things they wanted to cover. So that's an example of how I could craft it. More typically, people are concerned about things like, was my client going to make a good impression? How can I coach my client to be a better witness? I did one for a lawyer in the Bronx about 6 months ago, and he had a Yemeni immigrant who was a doctor, and he was really concerned about the kind of impression the guy would make. And there were serious medical causation issues in the case, but the fundamental thing he was concerned about, which we're all concerned about, is are they going to believe my client? So we spent, in that particular one, we set up a Zoom direct and cross. He brought in a defense lawyer friend of his, and he gave his client direct. Then the defense lawyer cross-examined his client, and then we debriefed the jury on that. And we spent, it was a 3-hour focus group, but we spent the majority of time on that, kind of debriefing them on what they thought about the plaintiff.
Did you guys do that live? I mean, was it pre-recorded?
No, it was Zoom.
Okay, gotcha. All right.
Yes. I mean, actually, my paralegal hosted the Zoom.
No, what I mean is, did you do, so when this plaintiff or this gentleman who was being examined and crossed, did that happen in the moment on the Zoom, or had that been pre-recorded and shown to the Zoom focus groupers?
No, it was pre-recorded and shown to the focus group. Yeah.
Did you break it down so you would do the direct and ask questions, or did you show it to them all at once and then get their impressions afterward?
I debrief them typically, and I like to use the term debrief because I think it's a lot more valuable than deliberations are fine, and I think they're okay. But I think a good debriefing is worth a lot more to the lawyer than just allowing the jurors to deliberate, which is the way it used to be done. So I debrief them after the direct, and then I debrief them after the cross. And I sent the lawyer the recording, and the next phone call I got was from him, and he got a $117 million verdict, which in the Bronx apparently is...
I don't know. That's going to be good anywhere, even in the Bronx, which I know produces some big verdicts.
Yeah.
And, but why... So I just... curious on that one. Let me ask you a few different questions on that. So you seem to be of the mind now that you like to just go straight to the debriefing, where you, as the moderator of the project, are interviewing and facilitating a discussion with the focus groupers, right?
Yes.
Do you ever do a bit of both? Have them talk amongst themselves, pose a question, have them talk amongst themselves, and then debrief? Or are you pretty much the mindset now that best bang for your buck is a professional like you talking with the group in a guided discussion after?
This is a constantly evolving process. So I'd like to say for now, at least, I prefer to debrief them first. When the pandemic first hit, I didn't really have deliberations at all. I found on Zoom it was problematic at first, till I learned how to manage that.
What's the secret to managing a deliberation on Zoom?
I think you have to really make sure that everybody's muted except the person who's going to talk. And what I do is during the deliberations, I have my paralegal do the monitoring of it so that I'm not on the screen. And she'll call on people, and not debriefing, like I'll ask people, what particular about the plaintiff's testimony did you find not believable? For example, that's a debriefing question. She might just say, okay, Joyce, what do you think?
Yeah.
Harry, what do you think? And then I found as time went on that I could just leave them all unmuted. And with Tricia there monitoring the conversation, they didn't talk over each other as much. I think I had this fear that it would end up being like a cable TV debate with people talking over each other. But eventually it worked out okay. And I typically like, to me, 8 to 10 people is what I like to use. And eventually it worked out. But right now the format I'm using, my default format in most cases, is I debrief them through most of the focus group. And then at the conclusion, we have deliberations.
So can you just give me an example? So we're talking about this case results in a $117 million verdict. And a big part of it clearly was credibility, believability, presentation of, and I'm assuming this gentleman was a plaintiff, right? He was the plaintiff. So as the moderator, debriefing that, can you give me an example of how you carried out? So you showed the direct. How did you probe into what people were thinking, what they liked, what they didn't, what they thought was problematic?
Yeah, a lot of that is improvised at the time because I'm hearing him for the first time, and with questions like, what's your immediate impression of him? Do you find him believable? What particular things about his testimony bothered you? What did you think about his affect? Those sorts of things. And this was a case of admitted liability, and he had a lot of complaints, which were, I'll just say, peripheral, that most people, we've all been through this, where your client has a complaint, you want to just keep this out of the case. It just sounds whiny.
Or clearly it's just a reach, and it's like questionable whether it's really related to the core injuries, right?
Yeah. And there was a lot of that. I think we were able to use the focus group to weed out the things that were central to the damage case and things that were, as you say, reaches or things that were kvetching or whining that didn't come through.
So on that, did they do his exam serially? Do it at direct and cross? You gather a bunch of information about what was working, what wasn't, and then do it again? Or was the feeling that you got such good information back about what was really not working and should be cut from the testimony that they just ran with it?
Yeah, I think they ran with it. I would have been happy to do that, to do another one. One of the things I'm finding is people are so understandably cost conscious because everybody's got a budget on their cases. And some people hear the word focus group and they think, oh my God, this is going to cost me a fortune. And I asked him, do you want to do another session? And he said, no, that's okay. And he might have felt, I don't want to spend the money. Or he might have felt, look, I think this was really good. And I think it probably was really good. So he was able to take that and filter it. And what he told me was that his client watched the focus group deliberations, the debriefing and the deliberations. And he said it was like a game changer, that this opened his client's eyes.
I had this one case, and it was just the perfect example of that, where I was the greatest concern that the case would rise and fall with my client's testimony. And sure enough, when we did direct and cross the first time, I mean, the people just, they did not like my client and they really, really ripped him apart. And I feel like you can't show that to all of your, there's a lot of clients you couldn't show that to. Yeah, I think it would be so hurtful or harmful, but there are certain clients like this gentleman, this case, and my client, that case, who they're able to just watch it, process it, internalize it, and iterate. And in those situations, I think it's incredible. But how do you walk that line between, is this one we should show it or not to them?
Well, I think that's up to the lawyer who has the best knowledge of the client's personality and the client's sensitivities. You know, they have to make that decision ultimately. I think that you either have to show it to the client, which in this case, the client was incredibly grateful. And not because of the verdict. He was incredibly grateful because he thought, boy, this yeah, is really right. good
stuff. Well, he was obviously sophisticated enough to recognize it, that it's a tool. It's an opportunity to improve rather than some personal insult.
Yeah.
Without stealing trade secrets, can you share with us a little bit what you do to recruit prospective focus groupers these days?
Yeah, sure. All the recruiting is done by my paralegal, Tricia. And she has a couple different things. She uses Craigslist. She uses different Facebook groups. And in rural areas, we'll hire somebody to go put up posters or flyers in the local supermarkets, coffee shops, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think the majority of it, I'm not in touch with her constantly about this, but I think the vast majority of it is off of Facebook groups.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've gotten away from Craigslist for a while, but gone back to it because I think if you ask the right questions, you can still identify some really good potential participants for your project. So I have gone back to focus group as of late. I'll tell you a quick story on Facebook. You can pay very little money to run an ad on Facebook these days. And I thought to myself, oh, this is going to be the magic solution for finding people in different counties and so forth. But I think it's not the perfect solution because I would say 80% of the response I got back were, I'm not sure if they were like robots or bots or they were people from far off countries, but just got some really bizarre people. A couple of them popped into our project and I had to immediately delete them because, I mean, it was a train wreck, which is one of the great parts about Zoom deposition or focus groups these days is you don't have to physically ask somebody to leave anymore or suffer through them being there. You can pretty much end it immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, I have some really interesting stories about that. I had one juror who was on his phone and got on a bus.
You're watching him on the bus, right?
Yeah, we shut him off.
After you realize that, not totally paying attention.
Yeah, yeah. And plus, probably everyone on the bus could
hear
what
this is true, too, right.
But, you know, there are certainly things about Zoom focus groups that are great. There are certain things about it that are not. And I've gotten back into doing some
Why?
Live groups.
Because I'm 100% Zoom these days. I just don't see the positives of all the rigmarole, the problems that come with people in person. What's the big upside that potentially makes an in-person worth it?
Amy Pardick, who was our jury consultant in the Indiana case, who I've used in other cases since then when I want to bring somebody in to help me, is terrific and she's brilliant and she hates Zoom. She says, you don't get the same kind of chemistry and honesty. You don't get the same kind of confidentiality that you can impart to a live group. And I think there is some truth to that. I think there is some, I don't want to say magic, but there's some chemistry in a live group that you don't get. The question is that chemistry produce results that are tangible and useful? It's hard to say, but you know, the other side of that is that I have had lawyers come to me and say, I want a live group.
Okay. And what's their rationale? Is that just what they have fixed in their mind to how they're done or what?
For whatever reason, they have it fixed in their mind, but it could be the same thing. Look, let me say to you, if Amy Pardick thinks that live groups are better, there must be something to it in her mind because she's been doing this 30 years and has had enormous success. I mean, I can tell you, she was a major part of that verdict in Indiana.
Sure.
The other thing is for me, I'm doing groups all over the country. When the pandemic hit, I started doing groups in Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Louisiana and the Carolinas. And I mean, I'm not driving down to do groups in those places. The cost would be prohibitive and life is too short. But, you know, Zoom has opened a lot of doors for me to do cases in different areas. But there are certain cases that are so big and the lawyers are so concerned about getting the best result that they want to insist on a live group if they think there's value to it.
Well, speaking of getting the best results, from your vantage point, if somebody comes to you, I do mostly medical malpractice, somebody comes to you with a med mal and say they are just beginning discovery on the case, what is your recommendation for the type of focus group to run? What's the best format and or formats? Like, does it change? Like, okay, we're going to start with this one and then we're going to evolve into these types of projects.
Typically the sort of thing, and I won't say I do a lot of those, but I've done a dozen over the years in different nursing home and medical malpractice cases that were not anywhere near trial ready, that were still in discovery. And the sort of approach I use is to say, look, if Dr. Jones or the head of the hospital, whoever, was in this chair, what kind of questions would you want to ask them?
Okay, so defendant, doctor, or the target defendant. And the idea being what? You give some little overview of what the case is about, and then you pitch to this group. Okay, now imagine that doctor who's being sued is sitting here, and you can ask him questions.
Yeah.
What do you want to know? And that's the approach there.
Correct.
Okay.
And that leads, of course, and like I said, these things are, they're more like jazz than classical music. Stuff comes out and you have to react to it. You can't plan. One or two people will start to go off in a direction and that will lead to other things.
Sort of like a deposition or trial. You have your outliner, but if something else pops up, you got to be prepared to go that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, the lawyer sitting, if it's on Zoom, the lawyer is not visible to the group.
Why is that? Why do you think that's important?
I guess it's a habit I got into, but I kind of wanted them. What's going to come up in their minds is, who is this guy and who am I doing this for?
Oh, I see what you mean. Meaning the moderator, you have to be on the screen, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
The person that's consulted you to do this, you don't want them on the screen.
Right.
Okay. Sure.
But we'll go back to them periodically, or they'll text me and they'll say, oh my God, try and find out this or this.
Yeah, absolutely. So then moving forward in the life cycle of a case, if somebody comes to you and they are a couple weeks before trial, what's your typical recommendation for the type of format project to run at that point?
I don't know that I've had a couple weeks, but a lot of them a month or two out. And of course, the big danger there is that they're going to learn stuff that's going to make them feel like they have to completely re-engineer their case, which a month out is challenging and possibly destructive. But I try, and having been involved in enough cases, let them focus on things that they can do something about at that point, help them prepare their client for trial. The word back in the early reptile days, the word was negative attribution. Discover things that are bad that they don't know about. And that happens all the time. I did one in a med mal case involving a woman who saw her family doctor and had what it turned out were symptoms of an incipient stroke. And he did not recognize them. And 2 weeks later, she had a major stroke. And the first thing out of their mouths was, she should have gotten a second opinion. And furthermore, two of her adult children are doctors. And this is something they should have done something about. And that was one of these cases where it was like a month out of trial. And I think that was helpful to them in that they really focused on, if you do medical mal, you see that issue all the time in failure to diagnose cases. But I think it was helpful to them in that they then knew they had to really bear down on that.
Mark, do you ever do the closing, the plaintiff closing opening argument, debrief, defense closing debrief type of thing, or have you gotten away from that?
No, I do that. It depends on what somebody wants out of the case. I would rather have the facts of the case presented in a neutral fashion, and I do that. I think one of the things that's beneficial to hiring somebody like me is, if somebody hasn't done focus groups, it's very difficult for them to do a neutral presentation. When you get into a case, how long did it take you before you could talk about a case and not appear that you're representing the plaintiff?
Well, I still struggle with that. I'm on a big kick these days of, and when a firm is taking a case to trial, should one of the attorneys that's trying the case not have had a lot to do with the workup of it? Because I'm sure you've seen this phenomena where plaintiff lawyer becomes kind of wedded to a case, to the extent that either A, from a cognitive dissonance perspective, it's too painful to think about the problems in the case or alternate ways to view the case, and B, they're just zealously for their plaintiff. They couldn't possibly ever look at it somewhat unbiased. And I think that there's an upside, and this ties back to what you just said. If somebody comes in late, and I've seen this myself, I think I've fallen victim to work a case up, I'm in love with the case, I see it my way, I go to trial, and I'm really missing a big picture aspect of it because you just had this belief of this is the way that the case has to be and made some big mistakes. And on the flip side, have parachuted in a few times with people in my firm, and I think have had a much fresher set of eyes on the case and was able to be more flexible in how we approached defenses, how we approached our testimony, what to drop and so forth, which I think all comes back to what you're saying, that most people, you know, are going to struggle to create a somewhat unbiased set of facts that they're really going to get valid feedback from a focus grouper, which is why they benefit from somebody like you, a third party neutral coming in and saying, no, here's what the neutral presentation is.
Yeah. I mean, I've had lawyers, really good lawyers, get into arguments with focus group jurors. I mean, following them out the door.
Right. Yeah. To win that argument, there's a lot of point to that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it hurts. I mean, it's painful to hear bad things about your case or to hear potentially how bad your case is, at least the way that it's framed, the way that you're presenting it in the moment. I mean, on that, you've done many focus groups at this point. What do you see are the biggest mistakes that trial attorneys make in whether it's picking what they want to focus on with you or how they perform their own focus groups or how they respond to focus group results?
I think the biggest mistake is kind of what I was talking about before, is they think the problem is with the jurors. There's something wrong with that group. I mean, when I was young and I lost cases, that's the reason I thought lost them.
Not bad lawyering or bad case or bad presentation, right?
You know, I've had a couple people say, hey, Mark, this was presented in a way that was just too favorable for the defendant. And I said, that's kind of how I do this. I try and present it neutrally, but I try and give a fair reading of the defense point of view. But your question, which I didn't really complete the answer to on the opening for plaintiff and defense, that is the old school, but I still use it in certain circumstances where people really are close to trial and they want to test right. their opening.
Okay, so the clopening format is old school. So what do you feel? You've been doing this now for many years. I mean, what's the current way to do focus groups these days?
Like I said, the way I do it is I look at what the lawyer wants out of the case. I look at the case. I usually review a lot of case materials. I mean, sometimes lawyers will send me 20 depositions to read. I won't do that. But I do try and read if there's briefs in summary judgment motions, things that'll really acquaint me with the case. And we'll get into a detailed discussion. And we may decide to show a video of if it's a federal case or a case out of state, there are expert depositions on video. You don't see this in Pennsylvania much. But we'll show them pieces of the experts' depositions if we think that's critical in the case. We'll almost always show portions. We'll have if the plaintiff's deposition isn't on video, we'll have the plaintiff record something. We did that in the current case. And any particular issues, there may be something like drinking in a motor vehicle case. There may be causation issues. You want to do it as a custom piece, especially if it's trial's 2 or 3 months away. You want to focus on the things that the lawyer feels, and after my review of the case, I feel, are the big issues that they have to overcome.
So the big potential defenses or problems with the case, trying to find a way that it can somehow be reframed, addressed, something along those lines?
Yes.
Having done all of the focus groups you have, are there any big picture takeaways, for instance, like certain issues that you cannot ever overcome or certain themes or factors in cases that, you know, seem to be maybe not as obvious, but are very significant to the outcome of a case?
There's been very few of them that I could say that are kind of slam dunks where you just think the killer. I mean, I did recently a railroad crossing case, and there was a video taken from the engine of the train showing the car. This is in a rural area of Arkansas, showing the car going through the crossing without stopping. And there was just no way they were ever going to get through that. I'm not sure. Of course, they didn't have that when they took the case. That was something they got and discovered.
Jim. But so your feeling is generally most problem issues that come up, you feel with enough time and effort and digging in through focus groups, you can come up with some degree of solution to the problem.
Yeah. And I even think before focus groups, we always had ways of dealing with those. If we knew there was a problem, the thing was you always meant, if there's a negative in the case, mention it in your opening. Don't let the defendant mention it there before. And to a certain extent, we certainly, there was a life and there were trials before focus groups. And we had ways of dealing with it. This is a refinement that enables us to spot more of those kind of problems and find a bigger variety of ways to deal with
them. Right. And yeah, do you feel that there every case should be focus grouped at this point, or are there some that are so straightforward there's no need?
You're not exactly an unbiased opinion, but I focus grouped every one of my cases when I was practicing, because there's stuff that comes up that you just can't anticipate, whether it's how people view your client or I had a case against Dollar Store or Dollar Tree, whatever it was, where it was a fall down case and they had destroyed the video or they recorded over it. And the manager of the store, the Dollar Tree store, had quit and had vanished. Two pieces of information. People started putting that together as a conspiracy.
That favored you?
No, that together with my client, disappeared manager, and my client had destroyed the video.
Oh, interesting. And you probably thought a missing video was going to play to your benefit.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we didn't try the case, but I reacted in a way that I would have been critical of someone else if they did. I said, we know that's not the case. So just
dumb idea.
I should have questioned them. In fact, there's a whole organization of trial consultants who do what I do in different levels and different ways. And one of them specializes in conspiracy theories that circulate in juries. I think you need to do it. Look, somebody like you that's figured out a way to do it in every single case in an economical way is fine. That's great. I think you need to do that. When I was practicing, I did it.
We do a whole different variety of things. Sometimes we'll consult out, and a lot of times we do them ourselves. And I don't know how you feel about this, but just to the point you said a moment ago of you almost have to do them because you're inevitably going to find out ways that other sort of quote regular people will look at your facts in a way that you just hadn't ever considered somebody could look at them. Like it literally just never even crossed your mind. And we will almost, maybe it's every other week at this point, we'll do a 2-hour project, but we'll do 3 or 4 cases. And the idea is not that we're getting, you know, this perfect information inside of the case, but we know that if we just show some basic facts or show a little piece of video or something about one of the cases we have in the office, we're going to learn a lot just about how it strikes people and what questions they're asking or wondering about it. And it also tips you off of, oh, maybe we should do a lot more specifically focused projects on this case, given what we discovered from that. I think that's pretty invaluable. I also think there's a big for doing ourselves, because I think there's a lot of value in having a neutral, a moderator like yourself who's not involved in the case do it. There's a giant value in that because you bring that unbiased perspective. You don't really care. You don't care if they win. I mean, you like them to win. That's what the whole purpose, like you're being consulted, but it's not your case. You don't have skin in the game. And so you can come at it from a more neutral perspective. On the other hand, I think I personally find that it improves my ability to talk about the case when it comes to the trial, when it comes to the opening. Like I've been through the case so many times and talk with other people about it, you almost get a vibe of how to talk about it with people, whether the language that they're using kind of gets into your brain or just the comfort level of talking about it with somebody like you would like in a bar or something. I think there's a big benefit to us by doing it that way. But I have another question as we're starting to get towards the end of the interview, Mark. So I'm sure you're familiar with the big data projects now, where there are groups out there who will run your fact pattern by several hundred people and get what is alleged to be statistically significant information. How do you feel about the way that either works in place of or works in concert with the more kind of qualitative focus groups that you are performing?
Yeah, I have had people come to me after they've done a big data project to get to do a focus group where they actually can see the people and hear the people and have someone ask questions about the case. I think they're different. Personally, from a task basis, that doesn't appeal to me. It's not something I want to be involved in.
Yeah.
It's too impersonal. I'm not saying that it's not valid. I'm just saying I don't want to do that. And there is, I think, a certain value in that. But I think also, I don't know what those people are seeing, how much they're getting paid. It depends on the particular project. But if you're paying, we pay people, depending on where they're from, anywhere from $75 to $125 for their time. We get them focused on the case. We know we've got them for 3 hours or whatever it is. And gives the lawyer an opportunity to see the people's faces and their facial expressions. And if it's live, their body language. That's another reason, by the way, that a lot of trial consultants want to do live groups. They probably each have their place. And a lot of it is driven by budget. And I think if these big data projects are really providing the same kind of quality of information to their jurors, it's got to be incredibly expensive. And I think to bring their costs down, they've got to give them less. Because given inflation, I found that juror expectations of payment have gotten much higher.
Oh, really? Even for Zoom?
Yeah.
Mark, to wrap up here, somebody reaches out to you, let's say they're several months out from trial. What's the process like of how they're going to reach out to you and how the process is going to go to getting that end result? How does it all play out?
Yeah, typically, I'll get a phone call or an email. I will ask them for some basic documents about the case. If the case has been to mediation, to send me the memos. If there's been a summary judgment motion, to send me the briefs. I'll read them basically and not charge them at that point. And then I'll have a conference with the lawyer. We'll figure out what kind of focus group we want to do, what they're most concerned about, what I think they should be most concerned about. And then we'll set up a focus group. And depending on their budget, and they may want to do it live, and I'll let them know what I think about the benefits of doing it live are. Or Zoom, and in the majority of cases, we're still doing Zoom groups. And that, I think that's driven by cost to a large extent.
And then how does so you run the project, and then what's the end result? What's the output that the consulting attorney gets?
Typically, depending on the format, we have a series of questionnaires that they fill out. And this is whether it's Zoom or live. After key sections of the case, they fill out written questionnaires. And usually I try and do that before the debriefing, because people will unavoidably be affected by other people's opinions. So I want their input before they hear what other people have
to
say.
Well, now let me jump in there, because that's the one thing that I have not really taken the time to figure out in the Zoom deposition. So I used to love, my favorite part of that I miss about the live, but clearly you figured this out, was I really liked to get the individual jurors' private impressions of the case before there was a group discussion. So I could see if somebody's opinion changed, why it changed, what was it, to see that before and after. And I guess my question to you is, from a sort of a practical perspective, how do you, via Zoom, get people to do questionnaires? Do you have a platform you have them go through?
I think it's Google Docs. My paralegal does it, who has a lot more expertise in tech than I do. But we do it after. If we're doing a Clopin type of thing, we'll have them do a questionnaire after plaintiff, after defendant. If there's a key witness like the plaintiff, we'll have after the plaintiff. And this is all before I debrief them usually. And then we'll have a final one. And we provide all those to the lawyer to review. And if they want, I'm happy to spend time with them and go over them with them. It's a fair amount of material. And I think that's one of the things the lawyers have been, they appreciate, obviously, being able to watch the video, which that's a big thing about Zoom. People don't often realize. I mean, we had to have a videographer or had to set up a video camera with live focus groups. Zoom just records everything.
Oh, it's the best. That's why I love it.
Yeah. And then they get these questionnaires, which, and sometimes you will see somebody give a certain opinion about something in writing. And then when deliberations start, they've changed their mind when they've heard other people talk. So that's pretty useful. And I think we give them quite a bit of good material after the focus group is done.
And so when you're running the project and it's time to do the private survey or questions, do you just have your assistant send them a link, or do they get that ahead of time in a private Google Doc sheet?
I think she sends them a link, but we should get her on here to answer that next question. But the key is, because the final questionnaire is usually 3 pages, we don't send them their Venmo payment until they complete it.
Is that usually at the very end of the project?
Yes, yes.
So you got it. So you do the whole thing. It ends with them doing a full kind of debrief questionnaire. And once they receive it, that's the trigger to get payment.
Yes.
That's great. And then what? Put that all, do the attorneys that consult with you get sort of some degree of a summary from you about what the takeaways were and so forth?
It depends. Sometimes they want that and I'll give it to them. Sometimes they don't. It depends on their level of experience and what they want. I've started doing that more lately, but I will do kind of a debrief with the lawyers a week or two afterwards just to get their impressions and see what they learned from it and what my suggestions are.
So, Mark, now that we're pretty much at the end here, we've talked all about focus groups, all your experience doing them, how you run them. Any other issues or topics or points you wanted to make before we wrap up here about focus groups, how people can use them, things to watch out for, do, et cetera?
No, I think where I started was, this is an inside, you're looking into the keyhole in the jury room.
And it's that we never get to when we're waiting for that verdict to come out.
Yeah.
Mark, I have worked with you a couple of different times, and I thought the work that you did for me on my cases were terrific. How, if somebody wants to consult with you to have you look at their case and tell them the best kind of focus group and run it for them, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
They can send me an email, mark@keystonejuryconsulting.com, or my paralegal, Tricia, T-R-I-C-I-A, @keystonejuryconsulting.com. Or they can call me at 610-633-1144.
And then I'll just give you one other completely unrelated but worthy plug, which is Mark is a world-class 5-string banjo player and is the, lead singer and performer of the Mark Schultz and the Wayne Rangers Band.
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
And what's your website for where people can listen to your music and potentially buy it?
mschultzmusic.com.
It's awesome. You're really amazing, and I'm in awe of your Renaissance mandom. And maybe one day, once my kids get older, I'll find some passion that'll be half as good as your ability to play banjo.
Well, Mark, thank you.
No, it's awesome. Mark, thanks so much, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on focus groups today. I got a lot out of it. And until next time, thanks for listening.
If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to the Just Verdicts podcast on your favorite platform and consider leaving a review. And if you're interested in co-counseling, local counseling, or referring a catastrophic injury case, we'd love to work with you. Call us at 412-281-4100 or visit our attorney referral page at pamedmal.com/refer. Thanks for listening.